As recently as 40 years ago, the idea of transferring body parts from one person to another was written off as a rare curiosity by most people in the medical profession. Today, organ and tissue transplants are routine operations. Almost 15,000 vital organs were transplanted in 1987. My guest, investigative reporter Mark Dowie, looks into the world of organ transplanting in his new book, We Have a Donor. Dowie has won several awards for his reporting for Mother Jones magazine. His first article exposed how the contraceptive device, the Dalcon Shield, was put on the market after inadequate testing and was aggressively promoted, even though the company knew of its dangers. Dowie also discovered that the Ford Motor Company put the Pinto into production, while knowing there was a potentially lethal flaw in the gas tank design. Mark Dowie first joined Mother Jones magazine as the business manager. The following year, he was named general manager, and he started researching the article on the Dalcon Shield in his free time.
I was dissatisfied with the quality of investigative reporting that the magazine was doing. When we launched the magazine, we'd promised to do a lot of heavy-hitting stuff, and we really weren't doing it. And particularly in the corporate field, which I felt really needed a lot of sunlight. So I just started doing it in my spare time. While I was managing the magazine, I started doing it, and I started to enjoy it, did well, won some journalism awards, and just gradually shifted into that part of publishing.
Well, along the way, I mean, you wrote some rather major articles pertaining to the health field. There was the article you wrote on the safety of the Ford Pinto and the deliberate cover-up by Ford that they knew that the gas tanks would explode in a rear-end collision.
That's right.
How did you go about researching a story like that? I'd imagine corporate archives would be closed to most people.
Well, they are, except that there was a safety standard that had been considered in the Department of Transportation that involved rear-end collisions. And I discovered in the files, and that safety standard was vigorously lobbied against by all the automotive companies, particularly Ford. And I discovered in the files, the files open to the public, memoranda that Ford had written to the Department of Transportation arguing against that safety standard. And in those memoranda were a cost-benefit analysis that placed a dollar value on human life, admitting that a certain number of people were going to be killed in accidents that involved exploding gas tanks, et cetera, et cetera. And as soon as I found that, I knew I had stuff. And of course, taking that back into the Ford Motor Company, confronting them with it, created wonderful interviews and wonderful responses. So that's where I got it. I actually found that story accidentally through a reconstruction man. These guys reconstruct accidents. And he'd done a reconstruction on an accident.
Well, like for the insurance business to find out how it had happened.
Yeah, and for product liability lawyers, mm-hmm. et cetera. And he'd come to the conclusion, we were just having a beer, and he told me he'd come to the conclusion on an accident that neither driver was at fault in the accident, but that the manufacturer should be culpable because of the design of the gas tank, et cetera. And that led to my investigation.
And the upshot of the article?
Hundreds of millions of dollars in lost liability against the Ford Motor Company. The first homicide trial against an American corporation in Winnemac, Indiana, in a terrible accident involving the death of three young girls. And the ultimate removal of the Pinto from the market. Possibly the ultimate removal of Lee Iacocca from Ford. I don't know exactly why he had to go finally, but they certainly pinned it on him in the trials that followed my article.
Well, he'd pressured the company, apparently, to turn out a car very quickly.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. The buck stopped right on Iacocca's death on this story. There's no question about it.
You also wrote a major article on the Dalcon Shield and the serious risks to women's health of using that, and that has also been withdrawn from the market and also great expense to the A.H. Robbins company.
Yes.
And you wrote an article on corporate dumping of products that had been banned in this country but were then sent to marketplaces around the world. That had sort of a less happy ending, if you can call it that.
A less happy ending in that nothing was ever done about it.
Precisely.
Exactly. Well, briefly, there was something done about it. During the Carter administration, Carter issued an executive order outlawing the export of banned and hazardous products from this country. The order lasted for about 3 weeks, because when the Reagan administration came in, one of the first things Reagan did was rescind the order. So we're back where we started. It is still legal in this country to export products that are removed from the market by the regulatory agencies. And it's done.
There's also now kind of an obverse with Europe now deciding to ban American meat that has hormones and steroids and other substances in it. It apparently President Reagan has been having organic meat delivered to him for 3 years?
Absolutely. President Reagan has had a custom butcher in San Fernando Valley of California named Bruce Oxford, who butchers his meat, which is organically grown beef, and he butchers it specially and packages it up, and the Secret Service comes by periodically, picks it up, takes it back to the White House, also delivers it to each of Reagan's children, with the exception of Patty Davis, who's a vegetarian.
And how did you come across this story?
Oh, there's a bunch of obscure little newsletters that I read. This one is a newsletter called Thumper in Southern California, which is a health and diet warning newsletter, and it just quoted this guy, Bruce Oxford, talking about that he chopped up meat for the president. And so I called him up, and there was a much bigger story there than Thumper had thought.
I'm talking with Mark Talley, a journalist who's written articles on all these subjects for Mother Jones magazine and has written a new book about, the harvesting of human organs.
Well, it's the whole transplant.
The whole transplant business,
not
both the
harvesting.
Science and the business
yes.
of transplanting. And in part, you acquired this interest in the subject through studies you did of surgery preparatory for your brain surgery. What was the nature of the brain surgery you underwent?
I had a rather obscure tumor in my head called an acoustic neuroma, and the advantage of having an acoustic neuroma, there are two advantages. One, they only grow in one place, and if they return in one place. They don't metastasize like other cancers. The other advantage is that they grow very slowly, so that after you've discovered them, usually you have some time to prepare yourself for the surgery. And I took 2 months and researched the phenomenon itself, the background, the epidemiology, and looked into all the different surgical teams in the country that worked on it. And before I finally chose a team and went in for the surgery. And in the course of doing that, I learned a lot about surgery and the impact of surgery on medicine, the impact of that surgery has on medical centers in this country and hospitals and the role that surgeons are playing in making major medical decisions now. And that all fell into this book as a sort of sideline to my own personal research.
One of the things that I guess that is common in organ transplant surgery is often the donors don't know that they've given up their organs because it's a decision that's often made after they're dead. I mean, whether they've indicated beforehand that they want this to happen. And the recipient often has a lot of time to think about it and to go through tests and to prepare and make themselves available to receive this. What did you find goes through somebody's mind while sitting and waiting for the opportunity to get a new organ, a new heart, a new liver?
Well, the waiting lists in this country are very, very long. There are 90,000 people in this country right now who could use a new kidney. There are 15,000 people who die every year who could have been saved with a new heart. These people are very, very desperate people. The numbers for livers are about the same as hearts, incidentally, about 15,000. These are very, very desperate people, and they all. By the time the decision has been made to transplant an organ into them, they've gone pretty much to the end of their disease. They've got a very short time to live, most of them. And, of course, then their families are equally desperate. So there is a tremendous amount of pressure that is created by this desperation that is placed onto the transplant community and particularly onto the surgeons and the direct health providers in transplantation. It's hard to know what's going on inside an individual mind. I can tell you this, that there's now a psychiatric specialty of transplant psychiatrists who do nothing but treat transplant patients and their families. They feel, number one, that the numbers are large enough to justify this specialty, and number two, the situations are unique enough to justify a specialty.
And I imagine some of the issues that come up are guilt at surviving and making use of somebody else's organ who's dead.
Yes.
Depression if it doesn't work or the body begins to reject
it. Guilt also at getting it ahead of somebody else on the list.
Uh-huh.
Often somebody right in the same ward, maybe even in the next bed. Guilt amongst families for wishing that their children or their child or would get it ahead of someone else's child. And they'll pass a mother in a parking lot of another child and they can't look them in the eye because they know that if one of those kids is going to die, and they hope it's not theirs.
Now, when you say a parking lot, this is because what
and
people camp out in Winnebagoes?
That's right, yes. Yeah. You have read the book. Yes. In Los Angeles, I discovered a family that was waiting, couldn't afford a hotel room or an apartment in Los Angeles. They were from out of town, and they were in a Winnebago in the parking lot of the UCLA hospital waiting for a liver for their little boy. He wasn't quite sick enough to go into the hospital, but he was too sick to stay at home. So he had to, they were living in a Winnebago. And the other family, the mother of the girl who received the liver that I was covering in my book, inadvertently ran into this family living in the Winnebago. And as she explained, she would have been predisposed to help these people out, to bring them food every day and to loan them money. And to, she was a good Christian, and she would have normally been a Samaritan in this case. But because her child was competing for a liver with the child in the Winnebago, she didn't want to have anything to do with him. And she felt terrible about that. She had to go into therapy herself with a UCLA psychiatrist because of the terrible guilt she felt about feeling this way.
How is the choice made about who gets an organ if there is such a long waiting list and a lack of available organs to donate? What goes in? I know that there was a time when Saudi Arabian princesses had their fathers contribute $500,000 to a medical school so they could get a kidney ahead of the rest of the line. Is that sort of choice still being made?
The whole process of selecting organ recipients is still evolving. But the case that you mentioned, which is a real case, which occurred in Pittsburgh in 1985, really shook up the transplant community in this country very, very hard, because it was a scandal. And the articles about it won a Pulitzer Prize. It got a lot of national attention. The federal government investigated it. There was a grand jury investigation, et cetera. I mean, it was a big scandal. To his credit, Dr. Starzl, Tom Starzl, who's that was the head of that unit, who was the indicted party by the press, if you will, in response to the press, initiated a new system of recipient selection that is computerized and involves only medical criteria. So on these large lists of people that are waiting now, everybody is categorized by medical need, medical criteria, length on the list, severity of illness, etc. And that, all that information is stuffed into a computer. And the computer, and they're tissue typed and blood typed and all the different medical considerations that have to be made. And the computer coughs out the recipient now. And they instituted that in Pittsburgh in response to the scandal. And I would say well over 50% of the transplant units in the country are now using that or a similar system. They're not all happy about it because doctors like to make decisions on their own.
And I imagine that a doctor also might be an advocate for his or her own patient, too.
Well, doctors, you see, there's this whole philosophy about who owns, philosophical question about who owns a donated organ and at what point it becomes whose property. Obviously, until it's out of the donor owns it even though the donor's dead or the donor's family owns it. But then the minute most surgeons now feel that once it is allocated to a particular center, that the surgeon in that center owns has the right to decide who gets it and owns the organ. They would never use the word own. They would say, I'm a custodian of it, or some euphemism like that. The fact is, most of them believe that they should make the decision. And the fact is that a lot of them still make social worth decisions. They will decide that a man who is sick, who has an income and four children, needs this organ more than a young woman who may have turned a bunch of tricks as a prostitute and had a drug problem. On the basis, just if all medical criteria are equal, a lot of surgeons will make a decision on the social worth of the patient. And people, ethicists, believe that has to be stopped. And the way to stop it is with the computer.
I struck, Mark, in reading the book about the jargon that's used, terms such as harvesting or procurement, and debates within the medical community about which use do you use, it in front of the public or not, and also the use of the words biomort and neonort, neomort, mm-hmm. for those who are brain dead, but whose hearts are still pumping and who are still breathing, and that some transplanting doctors see as the most vivid and most viable source of an organ to transplant. Is biomort sort of used up and down the halls of major hospitals?
No, biomorts is used more when lawyers are communicating with doctors on the subject of brain death.
Uh-huh.
The transplanters have to be very, very careful of the terms that they use in the public, particularly terms like harvest, which they use openly amongst themselves. I was at one transplant center, and there was a harvest. There was an harvesting operation going on in the operating room. Outside the operating room, where the family of the donor was standing on the wall on the bulletin board outside, in big chalk, it said organ harvest. So they looked at the wall, they looked at the door, and that's what they knew was going on inside with their neo-mort relative. A lot of transplant surgeons begged me not to use the word harvest in my book at all, because they believe that it's a word that triggers a bad response in the public. I told them all that as long as they used it in private, I was going to use it in public. And I've got countless medical journals, articles that use the term harvest, and a lot of them still use it openly, although not publicly.
This is a term that also raises issues, particularly in the case of anencephalic infants, children who are born without a brain, but otherwise are physically a functioning being. And transplant doctors, as I recall from your book, see this as a source of heart, liver, kidneys, perhaps even lungs,
pancreas,
yeah. Skin and bone, perhaps
and immunologically naive tissue. The great thing about young babies and fetal tissue and anencephalics is that their tissue is immunologically naive. It hasn't developed a surface antigen that triggers a rejection response. So a lot of the tissue is useful. Anencephalics are going to be one of the next big issues in transplanting. There has been legislation introduced in California and New Jersey to define anencephalics and dead as dead, even though in the strictest sense of the brain death statutes in 42 states that have the brain death statutes, they're not dead because their entire brain isn't dead. Only they're missing a cerebral cortex, which is a pretty important part of the brain, but they have an active brain stem, they're breathing on their own, and they don't fit the criteria for brain death. The great fear is that if anencephalics are included and become that the organ transplanters will then turn around and say, see, the brain stem doesn't matter. We've now defined a human being with an active brain stem is dead, so let's just change all the brain death statutes and eliminate the brain stem as a criteria. If you do that, then you open the door to including people in a persistent vegetative state under brain death statutes, so that somebody's PVS could be declared dead and their organs could be harvested. Mm-hmm. Whereas right now, they are kept alive because they are by law alive and they're fed. And we have no way of knowing whether they're not in an incredible state of bliss that we shouldn't interrupt by terminating their lives.
What goes on out in the hallway where a family has to be told that their loved one is a hopeless case, is not going to live or would not, you know, has had this damage? Could they, by the way, consider donating organs so that somebody else could use them?
The ritual of request is what they call it, the ritual of request. And that's a ritual that has evolved over the last 25 years since organ transplanting started and since brain death laws were instituted. And it's become an almost formal ritual now. It's required in most hospitals that anybody who is dying that could potentially be an organ donor, their family must be asked, or must, in some states, they must only be informed of their option to donate organs. In other states, they have to actually be asked to donate. Now the federal government requires anybody receiving Medicare money to institute a request protocol in their hospital asking for organs and tissues of people who are dying. So what that has done is create a rather conflicting role for nurses, psychiatric nurses, and social workers in hospitals whose jobs originally were to help the grieving and suffering people of dying patients, who now, because of the requirements of organ transplanting, have got to start asking for organs before people are declared dead.
You found a relationship about race and who donates organs, and that 90% of the black people who receive organs, those organs have come from white people, yet the ratio is almost reversed the other way around, and the black people feel that they don't want their organs going to white people.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here, and is this changing, and how can it change?
If it's changing, it's not changing noticeably. One of the most ardent campaigners for organ donation is a black organ transplant surgeon named Clive Callender. He speaks all the time in the black community, trying to convince black people that it's to their benefit to donate organs and to donate the organs of their loved ones. The black community, the polls that have been done of black people regarding organ donation seem to indicate that blacks feel that their organs are going to go to white people. And Callender is trying to convince them that that isn't true. Callender practices at Howard University.
Because amongst black people, I mean, kidney disease and circulatory problems are
higher than whites. Higher than whites. And the black people need, there's more of a demand among black people per capita for new kidneys than there are amongst white people. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that if blacks donated organs, they almost always go to black people because of the enormous demand. And so you're right. The ratio really should be reversed. And I think a calendar is starting to get some effect, at least in the eastern part of the country.
You've spent a lot of time investigating nefarious doings by organizations. The business of procuring parts such as cadavers and so on for medical research, like from the time of Burke and Hare and probably before, has always been filled with tales of skullduggery and nasty doings in the middle of night and robbing graveyards and so on. A lot of the transplanting business, most of it is certainly above board and so on now. But what kind of skullduggery have you come across?
Well, in terms of what the medical profession calls the solid organs, the kidney, liver, heart, pancreas, and the major organs of the body, there are not really any major overt scandals that I know of, and I don't think there ever really have been. There's been some cases questioning whether or not people should have been harvested at certain times. Most of those cases predate brain death legislation. But that's not where the scandal is in this business. The scandal is in the tissue side of the business, which are the less vital parts of the body that are harvested after the vital organs are harvested, the bone, the skin, the dura mater, the connective tissues, ligaments, that sort of thing. The industry that does that is a very aggressive industry. There have been a lot of scandals in that industry, which I don't play up in my book because I didn't want my book to be a scandal book. But one broke recently in Southern California where they discovered a contract crematorium that was doing cremations for a whole chain of funeral homes down there that were harvesting the bones of people before they cremated them without permission and were cremating them en masse and shipping, a mixture of ashes back to the funeral homes. It was a huge scandal. There's been several like that. And I think that if any part of the transplant community has got to reform itself, it's that part. It's the tissue banking thing. Tissue banking also is quasi-privatized, and it shouldn't be.
Is part of this because tissue banking, the tissues that are saved can last longer than the solid organs?
Oh, absolutely. You've got to get solid organs into the recipient's body within, anywhere from 4 to 24 hours.
So you have
or it just decays.
So you have this incredibly complex yet efficient system of jets and helicopters,
yes,
and phone beepers, right, to keep people in touch with one another and get,
right,
the organs across.
The guy in my book, who is the donor at the beginning of my book, he, within 24 hours after he died, his parts were in 32 different people in the country, corneas, his organs, body parts, et cetera. It's a very, very fast business, and it's amazing in that respect. It's very dramatic in that respect. The tissue banking part of it doesn't have to move that fast because you can store bone, freeze it, store it almost indefinitely. Same with skin and other less non-cellular parts of the body. As a result, you have a banking business on the side and of the business. And there's some question about the ethical efficacy of that business.
I've been struck by the high profile that some of the hospitals in Tennessee and Southern California achieve with their transplants, the baby Jesse, the baby Billy, the baby this, and, mm-hmm, the great sort of media play that's made, that almost seems in a way to pervert the good aspects of a transplantation in that these are seem ploys designed to benefit the publicity department of the hospital more than the actual child involved.
transplanters, and by that I include not only the surgeons but also the nurses and the transplant coordinators and everybody that fall under the rubric of the transplant community, have very mixed feelings about media coverage of their specialty. They know that that there has to be public consciousness because that's how you get organ donor drives going. And they there's nothing better than a nice heroic transplant story to keep a hospital on the front page of the newspaper for a while. On the other hand, the media darling aspect, which is what the media tends to respond to with the darling little children who only have a few minutes to live, is not really good because usually the media darling gets the organ because they've been in the media, not because they medically deserve it or need it more. And as a result, a tremendous amount of resentment starts to build up, not only in the transplant community, but amongst the people who are waiting for organs and the people who are supporting the transplant community and the public, et cetera. So it's a mixed blessing, all this media attention. And of course, it's a mixed blessing also because it's blown organ transplanting way out of proportion. And it has made us think of organ transplants when we look in a hospital, when really it's a minor thing that's going on if you look at the whole operation of a hospital. And organ transplanting's impact on medicine has been inordinate largely because of the publicity that it's received. So it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. They need it to keep the organ donations coming in, but they really don't need it because of the impact that it has on some other aspects of medicine.
Do you have a donor card in your wallet?
Yes, I do. It stipulates that my heart must go to a baboon.